next case this morning is In Re Interest of Ivana E.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tony Hernandez. I represent Douglas County Attorney's Office, representing the state. I would reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. Okay. Your Honor, the issue before the court is whether the state proved by a preponderance of the evidence that Ivana came within the meaning of Nebraska Revised Statute 43-247-3A. I think the court should first look at the trial court's order. The trial court found all the state witnesses probative and credible. The information and the evidence that was presented through each witness was found to be probative and credible. Additionally, the trial court found that Exhibit 7, the forensic interview of Ivana, to be probative and credible. It's confusing that the court overruled the state's motion to conform the pleadings to fit the evidence. The pleading was that the child comes within Revised Statute 247-3A. In Douglas County, we list sub-allegations to provide more notice to the opposing party as to what our concerns are. The state's motion to conform the pleadings was to allow the court to enter dispositional orders to address the drug concerns that was raised in the forensic interview. Typically in Douglas County, when drugs are not alleged and proven to come at disposition to enter urinalysis testing or chemical dependency evaluations, the court will refuse to enter that since that was not pled in the sub-allegations, leading to the 247-3A determination.
Does the record show that there was another juvenile proceeding instituted relative to the drug allegation?
There was another proceeding that was mentioned, but there was no docket offered to substantively demonstrate the proceedings that were previously taken on that were dismissed the day that this current docket was filed. There's no evidence in there demonstrating what allegations were made, who the witnesses were, what discovery was presented, but there was mention of
there was discussion docket. At the commencement of this trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
About a prior case, but
yes,
no other no other information you're saying is in the record about
no
that.
No information was ever presented to the court as substantive evidence demonstrating the previous docket.
Thank you.
That's correct. Next, after the court looks at the trial court's orders, the evidence that was presented through Linda Degner, the statement of the child, was received by the court through the medical diagnosis and treatment exception to hearsay. The child stated that Jay had touched her vagina with a gun. Mom was in the court. Mom was in the bedroom with her. Linda Degner testified that child repeatedly at every session stated she was afraid of Jay. Linda Degner testified to the post-traumatic stress symptoms that Ivana presented with, hypervigilance, hyperarousal. Those were correlated to sexual abuse. Linda Degner testified that she had been consistently providing therapy to Ivana since March to the time of trial in May.
Did Ms. Degner address the forensic interview that was conducted 3 months prior?
Linda Degner did not review the forensic interview. It is not normal practice to provide therapists with forensic interviews, especially because it requires a court order to provide a forensic interview to a therapist. But Linda Degner testified that it is normal practice for her to not review that, to rely upon the statements that the child makes, the corroborative evidence that...
Well, was there any evidence by the state to explain, if you will, why the child may have changed her story from the forensic interview until the sessions with Ms. Degner?
That is a point the state I intended on addressing. The child didn't state or change their statement. The child clarified a statement. The child, at the time that she gave the forensic interview, was in the custody of her mother, which was also residing with Jay. The child said during her forensic interview as a person with a beard or mustache. During the trial, there was no evidence presented that in December of 2017, Jay did not have a beard or mustache. She simply did not identify Jay as a perpetrator.
But she knew who Jay was.
She did know who Jay was. Yes, that is correct.
So why would she be mistaken about that?
There isn't a mistake. It could be a lack of full disclosure. There's a difference between a lack of full disclosure and a mistake.
But isn't that the judge's call then on a credibility determination?
What you have, Your Honor, is a 5-year-old little girl who resides with an alleged perpetrator who doesn't know that she won't be going home to that perpetrator at the time that she makes this disclosure and makes a statement that she is being sexually abused in December of 2017. In March of 2018, she corroborates her earlier disclosure. She's being sexually abused. Now she gets more specific to who's done it because she hasn't been in that home for 3 months. So now you do not have two conflicting statements. You have a vague statement with a more specific statement.
Was there any expert testimony to help explain the changes?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't. There wasn't expert testimony, but you do have a specific statement corroborated by an earlier statement, corroborated by PTSD symptoms, corroborated by the mother's statement to the child that was received into evidence that what happens at Jay's house is a secret. So you have significant evidence.
What, clarify for me, was the alleged incident at the time that the alleged incident occurred with the gun, was that at Jay's house?
According to the testimony, it was at Jay's house in Jay's bedroom with mother present in the bedroom.
Well, that was according to Degner. But according to
what
forensic
Degner
interviewed, was it at the previous residence?
The previous residence?
Because
the court
because as far as I understood the evidence, at the time the Degner interview, there was some testimony that they were now living at Jay's mother's residence.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But the testimony at the time that this event occurred, it was when they were living with a bunch of other people at some other residence.
Exactly, which is also interesting that the court dismissed the case simply because the mother does not reside in the home in which these incidents alleged, but the court refused to take that evidence into consideration in the state's motion to conform the pleadings. So the basis for the dismissal was, in the order, is that there is no mention of that he found the testimony not to meet the threshold requirement of proof by preponderance of the evidence. It was dismissed in the order because the mother no longer resides in the home in which the incidents that the child disclosed in the forensic interview, that she resided in at the time the forensic interview was conducted. So the court took the evidence that the state argued should conform the pleadings and overruled my motion to conform the pleadings as a basis to dismiss the overall petition without addressing any of the sexual abuse allegations, which is an inference that he didn't believe they met the threshold for proof by preponderance of the evidence. But I beg to differ that a statement by a child that's received as substantive evidence through a therapist for medical diagnosis and treatment, corroborated by the diagnosis that the therapist made and the symptoms that the child presents with, does demonstrate by our case law risk of harm to a child by proof brought on it.
But you had a problem with Ms. Degner because she wasn't fully qualified, right? It had to be her supervisor?
I don't believe there is any qualification for any problem there simply because she's not a fully licensed. She testified she had over 200 children provided 200 children with therapy, that she had 2,900 hours of therapy. There is no qualification in the medical diagnosis exception to treatment that the person has to be a fully licensed therapist. The statement comes in as substantive evidence because it's being used in the treatment that Degner testified she was providing to the child. So I don't believe her qualifications or lack of a fully licensed compared to a provisionally licensed mental health therapy licensure makes that statement credible or admissible or inadmissible. I don't believe it makes it inadmissible simply because she's provisionally licensed.
Does it give it less weight?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe it's received for the truth of the matter asserted, that Jay touched her vagina with a gun while mom was present, and that the child believes Jay poses a fear, a risk to the child, as she stated in every therapy session, that she was scared of Jay, that Jay follows her around, that she's scared of Jay. I believe those statements come in for the truth of the matter asserted as a fact. Now, if the court deems that those are not sufficient enough, I would be extremely concerned that the precedent that that would establish that a child statement isn't enough to prove risk of harm by preponderance of the evidence, simply because, as the court noted, IA didn't testify or police department didn't testify, but I believe that would be an extremely concerning precedent to set that a child's statement that somebody has sexually abused them that has been made consistently over 3 months isn't enough to reach the threshold, particularly with the PTSD and the symptoms corroborating it.
Any questions? Anything? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Katie Jadlowski, Assistant Public Defender on behalf of Ivana's mother, Louisa. I think this case boils down to a simple concept, burden of proof. In this case, the state simply did not meet its burden. And now the state is asking this court to substitute its judgment for that of the juvenile court. So the state can have an unwarranted second go at this. To allow the state such is inconsistent with the law and also inconsistent with the record in this case. The juvenile court heard and observed the witnesses and parties in this case, listening and watching in real time, contemplating that testimony and how it was presented. In consideration of those things, the court made its ruling and entered its decision, dismissing the thrust of the state's allegations for insufficient evidence.
Even did the court in its order address the sexual abuse allegations?
I believe it did, in stating that there was lack of evidence, and he enumerated the counts, including those of the sexual assault allegation, and dismissed them, saying that there was insufficient evidence. He didn't go on at length, the court's order, the way he did on some other of his factual findings, but I do think it was addressed and included explicitly in the order by stating there was lack of evidence. And as such, dismissing
the. And did the court discuss the forensic interview in particular?
Yes, it did discuss that. I believe it acknowledged Exhibit 7. I don't have it in front of me, mm-hmm. but it acknowledged Exhibit 7 in Ivana's interview, stating that it did find it credible. The court found essentially all the witnesses credible, and it put that in there. Even as such, though, the court still weighed that evidence, as it was the party there observing those witnesses at that time and that information presented, and it made its determination in consideration of the things it had observed and heard, including the forensic interview, which obviously is in the record, and you all have access to that as well.
And I haven't reviewed that yet, but can you tell me whether in that forensic interview did the child state it was not Jay?
No. Ivana never explicitly states that it's not Jay. However, in the first, when you have the opportunity to review it, in the first few minutes, Ivana is very open. She immediately recognizes why she's there. She tells the forensic interviewer that she was taken to the hospital and that her mom was freaked out. And so then she goes on to disclose essentially the underlying allegation of what happened to her. And within the first 2 minutes, I believe I have it marked, she says, we were at Jay's house. She knows him. She knows his name. She's familiar with who he is. But then throughout this interview, she makes reference a number of times to other individuals in the home, and in particular, another individual who she accuses of perpetrating the abuse at that time. So in her forensic interview, she's readily aware of who Jay is, knows him by name, doesn't seem to hold back at all, but never identifies him as the person.
Was she asked when she identified the person as having a mustache and or beard if she knew that person's name?
She was asked.
And her response was?
It's a little inaudible, and I don't have it with me, but you can sort of hear it. To me, it doesn't sound like Jay. She's pressed twice about it, and then she is coloring at the same time that she's discussing with the forensic interviewer the allegations, and she goes on at that point. She kind of digresses and talks about her picture, and the interviewer presses her, I think, one more time, you know, what was that, what did you say, kind of trying to clarify, and she doesn't state a clear name. But she does identify explicitly that there are, I believe, two or three other roommates and she doesn't know their names, but she describes them, and kind of in relation to where they stay in the house and coming and going. So she's very aware of who's in the home and talking about those people and explaining those things, and she does not name Jay as the perpetrator. So I think based on only a cold record now, the state is asking that this court, in effect, reweigh the evidence and reach a different conclusion than that of the juvenile court. I think Nebraska law, for example, as discussed in 214 Nebraska 425 in reinterest of Bisecker, that the juvenile proceedings are heard de novo on the record and that the findings of fact by trial will be accorded great weight because the trial court did hear and observe the parties and the witnesses. It goes on to state that the trial court's findings also will not be set aside on appeal unless they are against the weight of the evidence or there is a clear abuse of discretion.
Do you agree with the state about Ms. Degner's not being fully licensed? Was that an issue or not?
Yes, it was addressed at the trial. She is not a fully licensed mental health practitioner. She's provisionally licensed. That did come up at trial. I think regardless of whether or not she's a licensed mental health practitioner, which I don't believe it's in dispute, she was not at the time she offered that testimony. Even if you accept her provisional diagnosis based on her provisional licensure and the symptoms that she attributes to PTSD that she claims Ivana exhibits, I think it's clear on the record that something happened. And Louisa, when she first learned of that, as Ivana says in the forensic interview, her mom took her to the hospital. So it's very possible something happened. That doesn't mean it happened the way the state says it did. And even if that's the case, Ivana may very well exhibit those symptoms, but that doesn't mean those symptoms are consistent with how the state pled and enumerated its allegations in its petition. They simply have not enumerated the appropriate allegations, and they weren't able to prove that at trial.
Why was the court correct in its ruling to not conform the pleadings to the evidence?
Well, first, Nebraska, I would just note, is a notice pleading state. And so I think under Nebraska law, even under liberalized rules of notice pleading, the state needed to put defense on notice that they wanted to raise those issues. I think secondly, which I addressed in my brief, there was no consent to try new issues. We were defending issues that were directly pled by the state in its petition. And so we were addressing the sexual abuse allegations by offering the forensic interview. The state has the authority to enumerate and outline how it so chooses with the evidence it has, what it wants to include in its petition. I, by the law, had to get the forensic interview from the state. I physically got it from the state. They knew what was on there, and they chose, for whatever reason, not to include allegations of drug use, which they're now alleging they should be able to conform their pleading to. They knew what it was well before we ever went to trial. They knew those things when they made this petition in March, and they drafted it and they filed it. And the court was correct in not allowing them to conform their pleadings, first, because there was no consent, explicit or implied, to introduce new issues into this trial, those of drug use or other things that are included in the forensic interview. And there certainly was no notice that the state intended to bring those issues into trial. And without any type of notice, the state doesn't have to enumerate much, but they have to give us some kind of notice, in which case we could have properly, if they wanted to address those things, I very well may have put on additional evidence to refute underlying claims. So the state at this point trying to say that the drug allegations or anything else included in the Project Harmony interview should now be included when it very well had the opportunity to do so months ago and didn't. I think the court's correct.
Was there an allegation that the mother failed to protect the child?
Yes. I believe it's...
And would that still be true whether it was Jay or some other individual who was the perpetrator?
I think it could be, but I don't think the state proved that in this case. When this case initially came into the juvenile court, it was December 9th, 12th of 2017, and that was kind of an underlying basis there. I think it very well could have been proven that way. But I think even if the state proved that based on this record, and I don't think it did, they're still at the time we had the trial, they were unable to prove that there was a definite risk of future harm. The evidence indicates that the child is no longer in the home when at the time she was interviewed at the for the forensic interview. She was no longer in that home by the time she was again included in the new petition on March 16th of 2018, and by the time of trial in May of 2018, there's no nexus there. There's no evidentiary nexus. And so while I think it's possible and the state may have been able to prove with additional or other evidence that Louisa failed to protect potentially, they didn't do so, and they certainly didn't prove the definite risk of future harm on this record. Is that all the time I have?
Oh, you still have
okay.
some time.
Sorry. I guess just in conclusion, since I have a few minutes, I think the state, which you've already alluded to, has the great ability to interfere in that parent-child relationship. It chose to do so in this case. It can bring families into, those families that it selects, into the juvenile court and into the legal process. The state decides how it will draft its allegations in the petition, and it's then the state's responsibility to prove those allegations by a preponderance of the evidence. The state has not done so in this case. As disheartening as these allegations are, this event simply did not happen the way the state alleged that it did. And I refuse to accept that the state's casual approach to the truth in this case is acceptable, and I urge this court to not allow it either, and I'm asking you to affirm the lower court's decision.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is there time left for rebuttal? All right. Thank you both. We appreciate you being here, and we will take the case under advisement.